This podcast is brought to you by Labyrinth Marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Whole Marketer podcast. Today's podcast is a technical skill. It's all about challenger brands. And shortly I'll be welcoming today's guest, Lottie Unwin, to talk about the challenger brands that she works with. But before I do, let me just tell you about what challenger brands mean to me. Challenger brands are brands that look at an established category and take a step back and look at the pain and gain points that are happening and have yet to be addressed by that marketplace or category. And by keeping the consumer at the heart, they enter into that marketplace and really look to challenge and disrupt what is happening there by solving those pain and gain points that haven't been done by those established brands. This podcast is a case of you asked, we listened. You asked us to cover challenger brands, especially around marketing on a shoestring. So today's guest is Lottie Unwin, who is the founder of Copy Club. The Copy Club is a community for those who are under pressure to deliver entrepreneurial marketing, especially for those who are working on fast growth challenger brands. Lottie started her career in P&G, where she learnt the basics of brand management, before going on to run the marketing team at Propercorn. She started a supper club for heads of marketing at startups, which is now called the Copy Club. The Copy Club has grown and is now a community for those who are under pressure to deliver that entrepreneurial marketing. They will offer training, inspiration and matchmaking to anyone who wants to give back and share. And there are now more than 3,000 members and it's growing all the time. The Copy Club also runs the marketing teams at a number of fast-growing challenger brands, including fashion accessories brand Elizabeth Scarlett and healthier condiment brand Dr. Wills. So Lottie, welcome to the Whole Marketeer podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So as always with the Whole Marketeer podcast, we always start with a big juicy question up front. And my big juicy question today is, what are challenger brands to you?
Challenger brands to me are brands that are pushing against an idea, a concept or a competitor in a explicit way. And that definition is quite specific because I think it's a great question because it gets overused so often as a kind of buzzword in place of small brand or brand that is trying to be cool. And those are very much not challenger brands in my eyes. So it's about having a monster and getting a bit aggressive about it.
And explain to me more about that explicit. What's that trait that you believe challenger brands explicitly possess?
I think it's a bravery and a commitment to being a bit marmite. So that explicit positioning might come to life in copy that makes a direct reference to your competitor and explains why you're better than them, or product positioning that like clearly undermines an existing idea or ethos in the market. And that to me is quite different from what lots of brands do at the moment, which is about looking cool or shiny or interesting.
So how does that differ for you from entrepreneurial brands?
I think there are amazing entrepreneurial brands who are trying to do something better than what exists around them. So a great example is a frozen food brand called Byruby, who we did some work with last year. And Byruby make seriously special home-cooked frozen ready meals. They are not challenging anything. They are taking a category and doing a better job of it. They're not telling you that other ready meals are horrible. They are being entrepreneurial within an existing seam. And I think if you compare that to Dr. Wills, so a healthy ketchup brand who we also work with, Dr. Wills's point of view is very explicitly to challenge Heinz and to push their communication to the wire so that the Heinz lawyers call us. And we see that as success versus a Byruby that is simply trying to look tastier than other alternatives.
Got you. So a challenger brand isn't necessarily an entrepreneurial brand, but it's a brand to you that is looking to challenge the brand leaders or those kind of that are loyal and consistent in the marketplace for many years with both their own approach and also with their proposition. Whereas an entrepreneurial brand is very much they're coming into the category to meet an unmet need that's not been there before, but they're not necessarily challenging the existing players.
Yeah, I think they're a Venn diagram. I think you can have entrepreneurial challenger brands, but I think you can also have great entrepreneurial brands that aren't challenging anything and are fantastic. And I think that space is kind of under-celebrated. And then you can have challenger brands that aren't particularly entrepreneurial.
Makes sense.
So I think, you know, the old Avis communication that was like how Avis is the number two, they still behave in many ways like that. So they are challenging, but they're by no means entrepreneurial.
Makes complete sense.
I really think it's a great question because there's a whole load of marketing language that I think gets flung around, and challenger is definitely one of them.
Yeah, and I'd like to do my misconstrued Thursdays to try and clear up some of the terminology used by the profession that's, you know, not the correct terminology. And actually, it's interesting because challenger brands for me are brands that have come into a category and looked at the category norms and thought, okay, what are all the pain and gain points of the consumers that are not yet met, and how do I develop a proposition to solve those? So they're disrupting the category norms and step changing the solution outside what's normally been done. And I put normal in parentheses. But actually, listening to your definition, it makes sense. It's almost like, yes, they're doing that, but also the tone of voice and the way in which they communicate, and as you say, challenge those that are already in almost like a disruptive way, is another way of distinguishing between challenger and entrepreneurial.
You don't have to challenge a competitor. That is one way of doing it. You can also challenge an idea. So I think what you're describing there is brands who have a monster, and that monster might be the view that you have to do it a different way. And that's often the root of innovation.
Definitely. So whether you're challenging the players in there or the category norms, it still makes you a challenger.
Exactly. But I do think there's a dose of doing that through the line.
Yeah.
Like, that's not just your pitch deck. That's the way you communicate to be, by my book, truly challenger.
So what skill sets do you think marketers that want to work on challenger brands or entrepreneurial brands need to possess?
I think in both cases, there are two camps of skills that are required. So the first is genuinely strong strategic thinking. And by that, I mean clarity on what you're deciding not to do, laser-focused confidence in what you are saying and what is your strategic position as a brand. And that's not complicated strategy, but that's very confident strategy. And I think there's both the process of building that in your own brain and then selling that into the people around you and holding party line on that strategy that is really important for marketeers within those businesses. Because clarity of thought in communication and effectively not muddying the water at all is what makes a challenger brand clear and compelling. So I think there's that part of it. And then I think there's the executional hustle, which is a whole other side of your brain that needs to move from, I know exactly what I'm trying to achieve, to I'm going to pull rabbits out of hats to make it happen. And I'm going to turn on charm, and I'm going to use favours and intellect and resource, and I'm going to cut corners in clever ways, and I'm going to project manage ferociously, which all needs to sit around that strategic thinking. Otherwise, it's kind of worth the slides it's written on.
Okay, makes sense. So the strategic clarity of thought and the ability to sell in that single-mindedness internally, which for me sits across a skill that all marketers should possess. But the bit that do different is the willingness and ability to roll your sleeves up, get dirty, make things happen at all costs.
Yeah. And I think I agree with you that strategic stuff is shared by all marketers. But I think there is a confidence that's needed in it in a smaller business.
Yes.
I think the strategy is simpler because you have very limited resources. So you don't need a brilliant strategic framework. You need three clear bullet points or one sentence that articulates what you're trying to achieve. The strategic work in itself, I think, is tighter and more straightforward. And then I think it's about the confidence in holding your line on that and knowing when you're veering off course, even a fraction.
And I think there's probably some varying factors in that make those two scenarios play out, one around potentially the level of insight or the complexity of stakeholders or having to run cross-functional teams as part of your strategic planning process. You don't have that, so you have, I guess, more autonomy to set it, but perhaps don't need to go to the same level of detail if you're writing a long-term commercial strategy in a corporate.
Well, fundamentally, your distribution model is going to be more straightforward because you're a smaller business. Your touch points are going to be more straightforward. Your media choices are more straightforward. Time and resource makes your job in some ways more simple because you can only do one, two, three things versus a complicated corporate plan that just has more resource to throw in more directions.
So more single-minded, being able to have that clarity of thought, but then also the ability to use everything you've got in your power, in your touch, and even if you haven't got it in your touch, go and find it to make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what advice would you give to challenger brands on how to communicate and deliver campaigns as somebody who has worked across multiple different challenger / entrepreneurial brands?
Write down your monster. So the point I made earlier on, know who, what you're challenging. And Eat Big Fish has some amazing resources to help you do this. And I think over-index on tone of voice work. I think the more clarity you can get to on what is safe and comfortable for you and what isn't, the better. Because you need to be able to push those boundaries as you execute. And I think lack of distinctiveness is the kind of the key differentiator between challenger brands that work and attempted challenger brands that don't land anything with anyone.
So as a marketer who's gone from a corporate environment at P&G to then one who was running the marketing team at Proper,
yeah,
what was the biggest transitions for you? And on the back of that, I'm assuming that's why the Copy Club was born.
Yeah, exactly. There is no simple answer to that because it was like moving continents. I think that's like me saying to you, like, oh, you live in Japan now. Like, what's the one thing that's the most different? You're like, well, it's quite different, really. So to play back to my point around me having to learn what confident, single-minded strategy looked like versus rigorous, complex stakeholder management strategy, the intellectual exercise of really going right back down to how do you sell more of this product, I found really inspiring and really challenging. And I think in a corporate environment, you go straight into questions at a how do I sell more of this line in this retailer on these days? You rarely have the opportunity to go right back out and think about your product on the whole. So that was one thing. Then culturally, I felt like I was speaking a different language. All of the ways in which I've been taught to interact with people around me were completely redundant, in that it was a relaxed atmosphere that had no standardized form of communication, and meeting notes were seen as a little bit terrifying. I used to watch people around me like push their wheelie chairs back from their desk in kind of visible shock when I'd send an email. And you'd sense around you that you'd done something quite prickly. And for a long time, I didn't understand what I was doing wrong. And then I realized that no one else was emailing me. And you go, oh, okay, this is a culture where actually nothing's written down. And why that drives me mad, that is how this works. So lots of operational best practice had not been prioritized. And now I'm running my own startup. I'm like, I get it. I really get why those priority calls were made. It was all about selling more popcorn and not around, but guys, are we going to need to go back to this meeting in the future? Or have we aligned everyone in the business? You know, it sort of didn't really matter if people weren't aligned, because what was the priority was that we got stuff done.
So it's more about the action than necessarily the alignment.
Yeah, yeah, just much more of an impetus to action than a kind of Foreign Office diplomacy protocol. I found that I disagreed with a lot of what was said. So big business, especially Procter & Gamble, was phenomenal in terms of their recruitment process. Like, just an amazing machine in how they find particular breed of people. Mm. And that's not to say they're not diverse in like the traditional sense of the word, but they're not particularly diverse in terms of type of brain. They're looking for someone very specific.
Yeah,
I've and those that. People come in all shapes and sizes. Yeah, but like, a, you know, we're called Proctoids for a reason. And
I've never heard that, but it makes complete sense.
Yeah, I know. And you like spot another one across the room and you're like, I got you. I know how you think. And then you go to a small business where there are graphic designers and there are salespeople who've worked their way up from just selling stuff and then selling bigger stuff and selling bigger stuff. And there's a true diversity of perspective that, if I'm honest, and all of these people will know that I thought this at the time, for the first couple of months, I just thought they were all idiots. And I was really, really snobby in my head. And I learned an incredibly valuable lesson about the importance of being around people who have a genuinely different perspective, which in a corporate world, I just never saw. I was completely shielded from that in a way that I actually think is quite detrimental. I think it's quite worrying for people who don't have that kind of awakening. And then, you know, crucially, the difference that then led to the Copy Club was that I found it really lonely. So I moved from a world where I was one of 30 brand managers in the building. And if I had a question, I could go and ask the girl on Fairy Liquid, like, what do you think of my press plan? I don't really know what I'm doing. Can we talk this over? And she'd give me a couple of questions and tell me something her boss had said. And I'd go then into that review with my boss feeling a bit armed. And then I went to a startup where I was reporting directly into a founder. I was head of marketing, but like strictly in inverted commas, because that was just a title they gave me because they needed to make me more senior than other people in the team. And that felt logical. I don't think anyone had thought about it very much. So I was 24, like I was not ready to be a head of marketing. And if I didn't have the answer, the expectation was that I'd find it out because that was my job.
Mm.
But I didn't know how to find it out. So it was this catch 22. I'd be clueless, but I was completely disempowered to solve problems for myself. That feeling of loneliness, the feeling of being inadequate, that then begun to quite like erode my sense of identity. You know, and I've just said I came in feeling really snobbish. So you've gone from me being this like, I'm better than all of you, to quite a crashing realization of, oh my God, I'm really not. I'm really, really not. And I don't know what I'm doing. It was that feeling that led me to start making some industry friends. So going and finding other heads of marketing. And that was really the beginning of the Copy Club.
That's a great story. It's great that out of what is your pain point, you actually developed something to solve your problem, not just for you, but also for others that are in a similar situation to you, that potentially either they've come from a corporate environment where, as you say, they are one of many marketeers that they can lean on. They've got the safety of the structure and the processes and the rigor and the hierarchy and someone more senior than them and maybe someone not as senior than them and all of the rest of it, to now being accountable and responsible for everything marketing related and feeling quite alone. How has the Copy Club helped you and therefore the others now in the community?
I can answer that on my behalf, and I would encourage anyone to ask any of our members. I don't want to speak on behalf of our members. I hope the community speaks for itself. Personally, the Copy Club was a passion project for 5 years. I never thought I was going to make a penny from it. It was, and still is, absolutely at its core, something I did because I just loved it. I was meeting amazing people. I've made lifelong friends through those early supper clubs, through drinks, through video calls recently, where I've just found people who I just think are like fantastic humans who are so dynamic and motivated. And there's something about marketeers, but I really like them. And I really want to make them part of my life. Like, I just think they're really good eggs. They're curious.
I agree.
They are, like, yeah, I just think they're fab. And this was early motivation was like, God, I need some friends. I need someone I can call and say, oh, working for a founder is tough, right? And they'll go, yeah, pub? You know, and there was none of that sense of camaraderie. So I've made loads of friends through it. Through those connections, I have solved so many problems, like so many moments where I've needed a freelancer tomorrow, or a reference for a cost of something, or an insight into what a benchmark data point should be. And that's all just been at my fingertips. I've had phenomenal conversations with people about how they've done the work they do. And that's a really big focus for us. Like, we're not in the market of more motivational speeches. TED do a great job of that. There's enough people out there making you feel good about getting out of bed every morning. We're really into the how you do stuff. So heads of marketing managers at brands that you wish you worked for, like the Patched Plants, Pasta Evangelist, like cool brands, saying to you, this is what I did. This went wrong. This went really well. And this is what I'm going to do about it. So even this morning, I was working on influencer strategy for one of the brands I work on. And it's really heavily lifted from the fantastic work that Mona's done at All Plants. So Mona's head of growth, and she gave a talk for us. And I just sucked up everything she said. And I'm proudly copying it. And, you know, we don't talk about the name enough, but it's an old lame P&G in-joke about copy lunches. That's part of the story. But the other part of it is that copying shouldn't be seen as a bad thing. It's got such a grubby reputation. When actually being proud of someone that's inspired you and helped you out and cut loads of corners, I think is something we should celebrate. So I'm going to be really chuffed to say to the world when I launch my Elizabeth Scarlett Summer Influencer campaign that it's borrowed directly from All Plants. And I think more people should feel empowered to do the same.
And almost like using the community that you've created versus an internal community where somebody on a different brand to you might have done the same and you would have learnt from their findings from the campaign washer.
And that's literally it. In P&G, we would go to campaign wash-ups across functions, and I would be able to pick three things that I thought were really clever and I would borrow. And you go into a small business and you're completely blinkered. You have none of that. You get the shiny success stories on LinkedIn and you see the campaigns, but you never see what didn't work. You never see like the learning path, the journey.
There's because never
that's,
a mistake,
that's not what they're sharing.
Only a learning.
Exactly. So we try and create environments where there's no such thing as a stupid question. So you can say, look, I don't know anything about this. And then also a space where people feel really confident admitting that things have gone wrong and that there's human error. And to say, like, oh, I don't know how you measure that either. And even just going, oh, great. And that, you know, that's to go back to your question of, well, how has it benefited from me? There's been all of the functional stuff and the amount I've learnt. So kind of technical, functional. And then there's just the emotional support of, oh, it's not just me. Oh, thank heavens for that. Like, this is hard, isn't it? And we're all working quite hard and everyone feels like sometimes they're pushing water uphill. And I take huge comfort in that. It gives me a lot of self-confidence in feeling like I've not missed a trick.
You're not alone.
And again, I say, like, I don't want to speak for our members, but I really think they'd say that the same two things are true for us. And if they don't, our mission is simple. It's to make our members' lives easier. So if there are ways we're not doing that, we're such open ears so that we can do it better.
And doing things better comes from learnings. It comes from the mistakes that we've made and, like you say, learning from others. What would you say are your career highs and lows?
My career low is easy. At Propercorn, early on, because I had all of this big business training that taught me that reach was really important, insisted that we bought an out-of-home campaign. And we had like 30 grand or something. And it was quite a big spend for the business. So I'd really push for this 30 grand. But like everyone knows that 30 grand is not going to buy you nationwide bus stop distribution or coverage or whatever it's called. So I pushed this through and I took my team on like a big day out to find these bus stops. I didn't think it was as hard as it was. And we went on this kind of crazy Where's Wally Wild Goose Chase, which ended up with me and my exec standing under a flyover next to a motorway in Birmingham, looking at an ad that was basically facing a wall. And it was just a real visible moment of, right, I have a lot to learn. And I'd never bought media off a media plan that hadn't been given to me by a globally procured agency before. And obviously, I didn't know what I was looking for. So that was a real low. And, you know, not putting myself in that position again, not making big decisions where I haven't done my due diligence and I haven't asked people. You know, I could have solved that by using the copy club to three people who'd recently bought out of home what they did. And I didn't have that resource. And so that was the outcome.
Or an agency that you could have leaned on that would have dealt with a smaller media spend budget and told you how best to utilise it.
Yeah, totally. But I think that second one would have still been quite challenging. Like, it was really small budgets. And I think, I suspect I did talk to some agencies because my brain would have thought then that I needed an agency. I don't think I would have been comfortable with doing it on my own. So I bet I did talk to agencies, but it was probably just too small to touch the sides for anyone. And so I just needed someone to tell me to give up on it.
And also, not just even media, what's the right platform where you can get the greatest reach for the lowest cost because you're a challenger brand, I guess.
Yeah, totally. And then also, do we need reach? Should we really have just invested in point of sale to drive trial? Probably. In every level, that was nonsensical. And I really see that with hindsight, and I've learned my lesson. I think career highlights. Recently, there's been this isn't a moment, but it's a feeling. There's been this sense of a team copy club uniting. You know, we've gone from a team of 2 to 12 in about 10 months. And that's been a sprint, and it's been shambolic. And like, I feel like I've done more interviews than I've had night's sleep. Like, just, it's been a blur. But there was a moment a couple of weeks ago where we had a team day and we were all sitting around a table together, and I just thought, and coincidentally they were women, not because I've designed that, but that's where we've come out of the wash. And I kind of looked around this table and thought, there are some really special humans in this room and we can do some really special stuff that is really motivated by people and doing the right thing for our community. And I think that feeling is pretty magical. I don't think I felt anything as energizing as that sense of possibility.
And I think it comes on the back of what you said at the beginning, which was, you know, this started out as a passion project, this started out as, you know, your personal drive to find something you needed, to then find 12 other beating hearts that believe the same as you and are there to help you make your purpose and your passion projects, you know, bigger and greater to help more people, has got to be part of that, right?
Absolutely. And everyone will have a different version of the story. So within the Copy Club team, the 11 others don't have the same experience I've had. And in the community, there's now 3,000 plus members of the Copy Club in like the loosest sense of people who sign up to our newsletter, who are involved in what we do in some way. For every one of those, the need is going to be slightly different.
Mm.
I don't think that everyone's bought Terrible Out of Home too, but we've all felt like we need something done by the next day and we don't know how to do it. And we've all felt like, God, this is hard work. Does it really need to be this difficult in one guise or another? And the feeling of being part of something, the sense of being, of there being a collective whole, resonates for every one of those individuals in a different way.
And just lovely that you're there to help those on the journey.
I'm not kind of lyrical about it at all. I see our role as supportive, but also like very pragmatic. And I think that's quite an interesting thing for community building. I'm listening to a lot of community building podcasts at the moment, and there's a lot of like preaching.
I think all the great communities that I'm part of are with the people for the people, to the point you were making earlier. You know, you've got open ears. So if your community say to you, actually, I'm really struggling about how to navigate this, and there's a common theme, then you're going to find, as you say, the inspiration or somebody that can help and advise. And I think as long as it's with the people for the people, I think no one can go wrong.
I agree.
Lottie, thank you so much for your time on the podcast so far today. We always finish our podcast with the following question. What one piece of advice would you give to marketers of tomorrow?
I don't even have to think about this. Work out what growth strategy is now. COVID hit and the skill set that was needed of a modern marketeer transformed 10 years fast, like just jumped 10 years ahead. And that transformation had been happening. We've all talked around like digital skills, and every corporate's got their like digital center of excellence. And that transition had been happening over the last decade, like my whole career. But now it is simply not good enough to not understand how to optimize a conversion funnel or to be pretty literate in the difference between PPC and SEO and how to drive both and the role they can play for your brand and how to get creative made really fast if you need it and how to test and learn. And I think it's quite disguised as complicated. Like, I think there's quite a lot of dressing up to make this sound scary and intimidating. And actually, it's really not. It's really simple. I wish that 2 years ago I'd taken an intensive growth hacking course and, you know, taking myself out to the States and put myself on some high intensity program. And we're at the Copy Club offering as many tools as we can kind of throw at our community to help them with this journey.
Mm.
But I think it's like a now or never moment.
You heard it here first, now or never, everyone. Lottie, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. I've loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to the Whole Marketeer podcast. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please do click follow below for more weekly podcasts. The Whole Marketer book is now available in all good bookstores. For more information and support on how to have a successful and fulfilling career in marketing, go to www.thewholemarketer.com.